And you at least let me know when you have read them how you think this kind of work. But this is what you should read, because I'm not going to go into the length of fascism that I usually do, because I think these books are pretty much explanatory. Please read them. Now, as I said at the end of last time, that in this request, in this quest for control after the First World War, in this way that Germany moved to the forefront of cultural activity rather than France, in that, or even England, in that kind of cultural experimentation which comes with revolution and counter-revolution and all these sort of things, you have with it a general quest for collective identity. It has now increased after the war. That has something to do with the wartime experience of camaraderie, with the myth of the war experience, which I talked to you about earlier. You may remember also that the expressionists, for example, gave up their individuality and came to a kind of socialism, a kind of collectivity. And as I told you last time, even a rightist, if you like, like Ernst Jünger, whose famous book, The Thunder of Steel, of 1921, was one of the great mythmakers of the war experience, revised that book. It was I who had this war experience. Now in 1921, it is we who have this war experience. There was a general urge for a collectivity, of being at one at the same time an individual and a member of a collectivity, at one at the same time, as it were, having yourself fulfillment is collectivity. Well, let me remind you, that's just like the generation of 1914. That's just like these flaming youths who went to war, those volunteers, who wanted both personal and national rejuvenation. And you have that continued, really, not so much in France or England, where after the war things were pretty much settled, but in Germany and Italy, where you had revolution, counter-revolution, civil war, where everything seemed to be in the marketplace, there you had this kind of urge, this kind of continuation. But was there not a break? The great break in 1918 was, of course, the Russian Revolution. Russian Revolution was the most spectacular break, not only as an alternative government, also, of course, but I'm not concerned, so that in the German Revolution and the Hungarian Revolution, you have a Soviet of soldiers and workers' councils. You have for a moment in 1921, in 1920, looking as if the world revolution was indeed coming about. Lenin and Trotsky thought that the moment had arrived, because everywhere the Russian Revolution was being imitated, very often by people who had been trained by the Bolsheviks. This is true in Bavaria, this is true in Hungary, this is true in Berlin, this is true, in other words, in all of these places, in Italy even to a certain extent. So what you have therefore here is the possibility of world revolution, which in Germany lasted, remember, until 1923, the communist putsch in Saxony in 1923. Until then, this was a possibility. Now notice where it was a possibility. In Germany. And in Central Europe, but above all in Germany. And after all, Lenin and Trotsky believed that Germany was the key to Europe. That if you could have a Bolshevik revolution in Germany, then Europe would fall to the revolution. And it is in Germany that it nearly happened. From 1918 to 1920, I remind you, that stupid, you've never heard of it, I tell you, otherwise look at your textbooks again, that in those years there were Bolshevik revolutions, pseudo-Bolshevik revolutions in Berlin with the Spartakist uprising, in Munich with the second phase of the Bavarian Revolution, the second phase of the Bavarian Revolution, in Hungary with Bela Kun and the Hungarian Revolution, and in Italy with local putschists, above all in the Po Valley. These were not coordinated. They collapsed pretty easily. They had no coordination. They didn't even communicate with one another. So they collapsed. But this is not the alternative which really proved exciting culturally so much as the cultural alternative, which went hand in hand with that, and which is often forgotten, and not justly forgotten. Because there was a new freedom in Russia, unprecedented freedom, which went on with the soldiers and works as council. A new liberation. A liberation which lasted in the Soviet Union roughly from 1918 to 1924, to Lenin's death, when it vanished very fast. And that is to say, all the things that had been demanded, that is to say, the rediscovery of the body, nude bathing, nudity, sex outside marriage, free sex, all of this seemed to be lifted in those years in the Soviet Union. Artistic experimentation, every kind of artistic experimentation, from expressionist to futurist. Paintings, by the way, which only this month the Soviet Union is showing again. Until then, of course, they were forbidden. But now they're being shown again, so that we now know that there was, in those early days, for example, a very lively a kind of school of futurist art in Russia. Indeed, the influence of futurism was very great in those years. But the influence of German expressionism, very great. Italian futurism, German expressionism, these were some of the great influences on the Russia or Soviet art of those days. Now, obviously, this stimulated Germany, not France, which had become ever more provincial, and which the Russian Revolution did not influence culturally at all in a meaningful way. It did not influence England either. But what I said last time now becomes very important, that with that unrest, Germany is the experimenter in Marxism. We saw that already, theoretically, earlier on with Lukács and all of those, Holler, all of those, the Kantian Marxists, all the Marxist experimentation. But to that Marxist experimentation, which comes naturally out of revolution, soldiers council, rightist push, leftist push, that kind of thing after the war, you have now the cultural stimulation directly from the Soviet Union. And that is not only the founding of the Communist Party. You can say everywhere in Europe communist parties were founded in the years 1920-21, directly in the model of the Soviet Union. But that I'm not concerned with either, because the Cultural Revolution in the Soviet Union, in Germany and in Italy, had a consequence that goes far beyond the politics and affected even those who despised the Communist Party, who in the end did not want to be tied to the Soviet Union, who in the end, when in the Soviet Union all this was forbidden, which is after 1924, when the Soviet Union becomes what it is today, the exemplar of a petty bourgeois society, the culture remains, the culture aspect remains. And it remains, of course, in Germany. And here there is, you remember, a political side to it. The drawing closer of the Weimar Republic and the Soviet Union, something that is symbolized by the Treaty of Rapallo in 1922, when Germany and the Soviet Union made a treaty of commerce, but when the two great losers of the First World War, and the Soviet Union and the Weimar Republic, seemed to get together, so that the spirit of Rapallo really facilitated this penetration of Soviet culture into Germany, there was an official drawing together as well of the two great losers at the Treaty of Verpalo. Between 1913 and 1923, proletarian theaters were founded in Germany. Proletarian theaters which wanted to go beyond what had been the so-called popular theater. There had always been a popular theater movement. But these were just ordinary theaters which were open to the working classes by subscription, something the Nazis, the fascists, were going to do. In other words, as part of the trade union movement, you could subscribe cheaply to a theater and opera program. These kind of things existed ever since the 1880s, and they were called Volkstheater, a popular theater. But the theaters that were shown were the usual German classical theater of one sort or another, nothing very experimental, Kleist's Kitchen and all of that kind of thing. But now, there was a conscious attempt to combine proletarian theater with getting rid of the bourgeois heritage. For at that moment, in the Soviet Union, the slogan was to get rid of the bourgeois heritage. Later on, when Stalinism was to defeat all this, the idea was that we must not get rid of the bourgeois heritage, that we must keep the bourgeois heritage, that we must keep tradition. That is, of course, today almost a mockery, because it's only in Eastern Europe now that you visit national monuments, that you wear tuxedos to official things, and that you're back in the 19th century. In other words, tradition slayer, a tradition. I told you that when the DDR ambassador visited me 3 years ago, he brought not a piece of Meissen, but instead something from German tradition. Traditionsleger. Yeah? Usually they go around with something from Goethe's Garden, a very ugly plant, but then mine. So tradition has taken the place. And therefore, this phase has a title. It is called Prolet Cult, the cult of the proletariat, the Prolet Cult phase. And the Prolet Cult, which was condemned by Lenin in the end, and liquidated the bourgeois tradition, is only a phase. But in the West, it will be very important. And why did Lenin condemn it? Because according to Marxism, don't forget, classical culture is good culture. In other words, the bourgeois at its height produced wonderful culture. Shakespeare, Goethe, Schiller. But the bourgeois, when it became the oppressive class, and when the proletarian had risen, produced no good culture. That is why socialism could never come to terms with modern culture before this time. And that is why Lenin, in the end, condemned what we call the prolet cult, or the proletarian cult, the cult of the proletariat, because it seemed to attack classical culture, that is, Goethe, Schiller, Shakespeare, and it was not to get. When you think of these great revolutionaries like Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, what they read was Goethe, Schiller, Shakespeare, and things that Marx read. And they had no relationship at all to modern culture. In modern culture, socialists were illiterate, completely illiterate, because this goes in Marxist theory. And the break came, in fact, with this cult of the proletariat. And it came in a very odd way, because the idea was, we must get rid of the bourgeois, we must create something new. And so what happened, in fact, is that they passed on to the largely German, certain extent the French avant-garde, and that you have in this Prolet cult a kind of Prolet cult, you have a kind of freedom and experimentation which had a great effect. Between 1939 and 1923, the proletarian theaters were started as an attempt to get rid of the bourgeois heritage. That theater was above all founded in 1924 by a young director destined to be a Croswell famous, is cut off in Berlin. Perhaps if I read you what Pascato said about his proletarian theatre, we might come closer to it. But it is, in fact, Pascato's proletarian theatre, which, as it were, wants to, or was indeed, the home and the important man. Now, what he said, proletarian theatre must have this as aim: simplicity and expression. And simplicity, of course, in staging. It must be directed clearly on the sensibilities of the workers. And the art must be subordinated to the revolutionary goal. Therefore, a proletarian theatre has consciously to propagate class struggle. Consciously class struggle. Therefore, there must be no cult of the person, either a cult of the actor or in the play, any kind of cult of the person. Instead, the idea of class struggle must always, as it were, stand in the center. And that means that form is everything, content is nothing. Now, what does that mean? Form is everything, content is nothing. It means to him that the theatre is education, as we say in German, Lehrstuhl. That play must educate. That the content is given, the content is always the same. It's the class struggle. And therefore, the only thing that really counts is the form in which you put it, the form in which you put it across. And the form in which you put it across was, of course, stereotype. And it was, of course, new kind of stage, the use of the film, and the use of transparency. Now, you associate all this with Brecht, but remember that Piscator is the man who put Brecht on the map. Piscator is the man who staged Brecht, and who put Brecht in the map. Brecht has been an expressionist writer. And indeed, Brecht's idea of the epic theatre is what I have just told you. That the theatre's content is not as important as the form. And that indeed, Piscator's political theatre is identical with Brecht's theatre, Lehrstücke, theatre as teaching. And therefore, the plays must be in stereotype. The capitalist, the peasant, the mother, the son, the oppressed. That's fresh. Secondly, there must be no character portrayal. No character. That's Cazone's cult, the cult of personality. No character portrayal at all. And thirdly, the audience must have a distance. You look at this not as a play, but as being taught a lesson. Now, the proletarian theatre and Brecht theatre was a monumental failure, is a monumental failure. Because if Brecht was really like that, you wouldn't remember it. But the problem with Brecht is, it didn't work. You do empathize with the mother in Mother Courage. The mother in Mother Courage does become an object of personality cult. Brecht was a colossal failure, and that made him a success. If you looked at Brecht the way Piscator wanted you to look at Brecht, and Brecht himself wanted to look at Brecht, it would be an uninteresting kind of political, it would have been only interested to his story. He wanted to see what was going on. But the very success of Brecht is that you do empty up. You do cry with Mother Courage and you lose all that. You empathize with the woman in the chalk circle. So of course it was a failure. But Piscator continued this kind of theater, but it was even a failure in his own time. That is to say, more and more he was forced to do traditional things. Not all the workers are no different than ourselves. When they finish work, they don't want education. They want relaxation, yes? It's an absurd idea to think that if a worker has finished all that work, he wants to be educated by Piscator on Gresh, yes? He wants to have his halber pinter, he wants to have his beer, he wants to have his sex, and he wants to have his entertainment. And I think any socialism that is geared to beer, sex, and entertainment after work is in trouble. And they are certainly in trouble, because these are after all workers, and not unemployed middle-class intellectuals who use Gresh. So, what happened was clear, therefore, it was a failure. Instead, it has remained, for some reason I'm not sure, fascinating. If you ever saw any Piscator things after the Second World War, where he then come back into Berlin State, there were a monumental war. I might have walked out of my pipe, or something like this, in 5 times. Did a thing about Auschwitz and dreadful, I thought. But there is a kind of fascination with it. Because what is true about it, it is the only real attempt at socialist art. That is to say, it is a real attempt of putting into practice what Engels and Marx to a certain extent had hoped. That is to say, to tie the drama to the class struggle, to the end of the class struggle, to prevent the person, cult of personality, and all of these things are, of course, clear. But it is interesting that what was really popular was not Piscator. What really became popular from Russia was not the proletarian theater, which even in Russia went down, but instead what we call in German the review. What do you call that in English, a review? You know, scene after scene. What do you call it? You know, one scene after another. Political covering. Covering. What really became important was the covering. If Piscator founded his political theater, as I did from in 1920, no, not 20, in 1920, right after the war, then the great event was in fact, the great event of 1923-22, when a Soviet covering came to Germany. And that Soviet cabaret was called the Blau und Blue, the Blue Blouses, or the Blue Shirts, if you like. But Blusen is really more blouses. You know what the Russians wear these kind of things, yeah? What you call the blouses? Well, never mind. The Blue Blouses. When they came, it was a revelation. And from then on, what we call agitation and propaganda. Agitprop. But mothers on the Blue Blouses, to a very large extent, both in the cabaret or in guerrilla theater. The kind of guerrilla theater, by the way, that you had, as I've just said, that you had in Kulavanka, or when you looked at Kulavanka. Now, what did they do? What did they do? All right, let me give you a program of the Blue Blouses. The program of the Blue Blouses, a program, Soviet theater, pathos, humor, satire, lyric, etc. Introduction. Introduction, a parade, a march. And to that march, the actors come to the stage and introduce themselves. Second, parade of the Soviet press. A parade of the main papers of the UDSSR, of the Soviet Union, in costumes of Roman gladiators. On each newspaper carries a placard in which the title of the newspaper is given in German. The newspaper comes in two parts. The first part is dancing of colorful figures with class struggle placards. It's down with the bourgeoisie, etc. Yes? Every newspaper is introduced to the public in word and song, and gymnastics are added. The actors play a printing machine, a worker, a printer, a brochure. Third, finish, the next one. an event of China, in China. At the merchant Natashi lives an orphan boy, so young. And a Chinese coolie loves Song Yong. But Song Yong is asked to do a degrading work. He refuses to do degrading work. He is threatened with death. And indeed, the girl joins him in death. Fourth, the next number, just to cheer you up, is a gymnastics number. Sport, dancing, and boxing. Boxing against the capitalist enemy. The fifth number is Henry Ford and Us. And Ford, a mass production. Ford and Us, well, you can do it yourself. They act out they act out mass production, and they act out how the workers feel on the band of mass production, and all of this. And then they act out how the worker feels in the U.S., in the Soviet Union, and how there is no mass production in the Soviet Union. Well, seventh is the Red Army, and then they come and make military exercises with a live machine gun and things like that. And the slogan is, we don't want war, but we are prepared. Well, I don't have to go through it, but it is clear that that is a mile, light mile away from the workers' theater of Piscato. This is acting it out. This is simple, but amusing. You get it through dance, through gymnastics, and through color. Yes? Gymnastics. The criticism, of course, in all the German socialist papers, which Preston said, this is not expressionistic. But that is simple. The class struggle again is very much in the forefront of the blue blouses, very much in the actual forefront of the play. For example, Wilhelm Pieck, then a labor leader, destined to become the first president of the German Democratic Republic after the war, Wilhelm Pieck praises him for being simple, having a good tempo, speed, no boredom, discipline, keenness, and the workers, this comes from a worker, Wilhelm Pieck was a worker, and he says very typically that here the workers cease to be tired after work. They're woken up by the tempo, the dynamic, the fast-moving scene, right? Clear. They immediately become the contact between the cabaret and the blue blouse. This is the best kind of propaganda. It comes from the midst of the life of the workers, and it propagates the class struggle. The class struggle, and we hope to see more of it. They did. Until 1928, the blue blouses came almost every year, made a tour through Germany, and thereby really stimulated what became the chief form of agitprop. Above all, one thing in this cabaret which the Nazis imitate and which was to become a almost passion for the communists and Nazis alike, though the Soviets started it, speaking choruses in which the audience talks. That is to say, fighting slogans quoted by the audience, by hundreds of people, what began here. And of course became such a passion of Nazi movement that it was eventually forbidden in 1938 because they did nothing else but that, as mass meeting, all these kinds of speaking choruses. But it was an imitation of this. Now, to a certain extent, these methods were so successful that they were taken over by the right. And you get Nazi guerrilla theater, and never very, really, very successful. But also simple, also cabaret like, also in the street, just as the cabaret was carried to the workers, and I refer you again to Kuhlenbacher, Well, at the end, I don't think you can see it very well in the film, in that Worker Sports Festival, you have in the middle of mowing and football and whatever the workers are interested in, really, you have a group of actors coming and acting out. Cabaret form, not rear strip, but cabaret form, a rear. Finally, this idea of a cabaret, of course, is why it went so well. It's really connected to the culture of the Weimar Republic, very deeply. Because this was a general cultural phenomenon. Haven't you seen the movie Cabaret? Huh? Haven't you seen the movie? Huh? Well, it was a general phenomena in the Weimar Republic, but not a phenomena for the class struggle, but a phenomena for amusement, a phenomena which went together with Berlin city, above all a phenomena of sexual stimulation. Now why in the Weimar Republic this great love for cabaret, what we call in Germany the revue? As a review. Review means simply looking at a lot of pictures. These are living pictures. The cabaret is living pictures. And here I must refer myself to something you already know, forward and back. First of all, the cabaret was a good form in times of disturbance. I mean, it's very jerky. It's not continuous. One picture after another. It sort of fuses with the general revolutionary excitement, with the general poverty, with the general excitement of the city. So you will find, I think, cabaret very popular whenever you have discontinuity, because in the modern theatre, it is the chief discontinuous art form. And that again plays into something you already know, into expression. For it is, in spite of what Wilhelm Pieck said, very closely related. Expressionism wanted sensation. One sensation to another. It was discontinuous. It wanted sensation. It was abrupt. All expressionist drama are a series of pictures. All expressionist drama is in form of a cabaret. Thousand Flavors, Father Murder, or Father Ward, or all the things we've talked about, is in form, in fact, a cabaret. A series of pictures. Now, why is that important? Because expressionism here, not only was important in the cabaret, but in the early film. And when you see Dr. Caligari, is it this week?
Oh, it's Berlin this week.
Well, when eventually you see Dr. Caligari, the famous Weimar film, then please notice about it. Take a note now. The abrupt change of pictures. Oh, you already said that. All right. In Caligari, you've seen it. The abrupt change of pictures. The abrupt change of lighting. Caligari is an expressionist film because of the abrupt changes. The abrupt change of lighting. And you have there, too, in Caligari, not only the kind of Weimar theme, which I shall come back to, of the dictator, of the Frankenstein, if you like, of course, the preoccupation of the time, but you have something that links it directly to the cabaret. In fact, Caligari is a kind of cabaret in the film. The cabaret became the favorite kind of art form for both the rich and the poor, the Weimar Republic. For different reasons and for the same reason. It was entertaining. It was abrupt. It tied in there to the time, the tempo of the time. And it was expressionistic. I mean, it had an artistic tradition. So the last thing I wanted to say about it, the importance of life. The importance of lighting here is crucial. Both in Caligari, you notice the lighting in the film, it's very important that it's an expressionist kind of lighting. The first modern lighting, I think, which you have there in Caligari. The idea of darkened light, again, the idea of contrast, abrupt contrast, which you have in every cabaret. In every cabaret, lighting is very important. because they have to be cognized. Light and dark. Now, in the kind of suffering you saw in the movie, these contrasts are to stimulate you sexually. But in the workers' cabaret, in the blue blouses, in ugly frocks, they're of course to entertain you, to excite you, to get you to fight the class struggle. Yes? You see what I mean? But they are for entertainment. But it's the same thing, light and dark, the very abrupt change. No continuity. Now you may say rightly, how does that fit in, what I said earlier, how does that fit in with the idea of collectivity? Well, I think it does, because what you have here again is a mix. Individualism and collectivity. Individualism, if you like, to a certain extent, at any rate, by this address to yourself as a person. You are addressed in this cabaret. The blue blouses will come down. They will say, you. It does not like in this cabaret there are many personalized factors. In other words, even in the middle class cabaret, you know, the beautiful girl comes down and sits on your lap eventually, yes? Swing there. I think there's a scene like that in the movie, if I remember right. She comes down, who is it? Is it one of Frank Sinatra, Elizabeth Dorsey? Yes, yes. Anyhow, however it might be, but the girl comes down and she sits on your lap in one way or another, yes? And in the workers, the blue blouses, and I come to this now, left the stage and went to the audience. Said, you. So, in a sense, the cabaret is a collective appeal. And yet, it appeals to you as individual. It really combines, for the worker, the weak personal and general rejuvenation. It tries to illustrate that. Now, to be sure, Piscator's theater illustrates it too. But Piscator's theater illustrates the abstract. Here it's illustrated in the concrete. These are stereotypes, but they're living stereotypes. They're stereotypes of this old form, anyway. But they are stereotypes in dark, colorful costumes. And they do interesting things. They walk. In fresh, they talk and talk and talk and talk. But here not. And all intellectual efforts for the workers have a Mars festival as well. They didn't work if there was too much talking, obviously. It has to be a kind of excitement. But even the middle-class cabaret, if you like, even the middle-class cabaret combines it, if you like, in a decadent manner. Decadent, the individual and the collectivity, in a sense, because there is both. In the cabaret on the stage, by the way, I always forget that you may not have seen much of cabaret. On the stage is a combination between group activity and singular activity. It's kind of like the vaudeville. I don't know whether the vaudeville is at all associated with it. I'm just ignorant of that. But you have not seen much cabaret. But it still exists today. But today it has again become, in these quiet times, a thing on the fringe. There are famous political cabarets in Germany today. But they're things on the fringe. Then cabaret was in the center, not of the fringes. We must remember that. Now, to summarize that, the influence of the Russian Revolution culturally is great, both in the proletarian cult of the early revolution, which stimulated, of course, new bathing and sexual freedom in Weimar Republic, that must not be underestimated. And, of course, it stimulated the artistic experimentation. It didn't cause it, but it stimulated it very much until 24. But in the theater, and above all, I think, in the new art form, the cabaret, the rejection of sentiment. These were not sentimental activities. There was not much kitchen sentiment about it. Not much of the love story kind of thing about it. None of it. But rather, a search for individualism and camaraderie. Rather, a kind of realism. Whether it is the realism of sex or the realism of the class struggle. None of these were any more disguised sentimentally syrupy. If you ever saw the movie Cabaret, some of you must have seen it, it's always around. You will, if you see the game now, you will notice that the cabaret scenes are not sentimental at all. They are very straightforward in that sense. And the sex and so on and the political satire is undisguised. It is really a new stage in the history of political satire. Because in all of it, there is something very important underlying what we call in German the Neue Sachlichkeit, the new fragment. Whether you have all these art forms, there is a new pragmatism. The world has collapsed. Revolution, counter-revolution, poverty, economic crisis, one after another, meant, in a sense, that you have a pragmatism, a new pragmatism, on this level. Let me be clear again when I say this. The general populace is made for a greater sentiment. In other words, if you have complete disturbance, something difficult for you to realize, I think, because you led very sheltered lives, of course, in post-war children. But if you have a world of revolution, counter-revolution, if you have a world of economic depression, above all, if you have a world where you don't know what's going to happen the next moment, then two reactions are possible. One is a heightened sentiment to read fairy tales. You read of a happy and healthy world. That is the majority. That is what fascism builds. And the other reaction is a greater pragmatism, a greater way to cope with it, a greater pragmatism. And that is what we are concerned now, because that, of course, had the cultural effect. The sentimentalism continues. It's difficult to be clear to you, really, what it means. I can only make it clear, perhaps, by proxy, that in the 1930s, somebody like myself, then more or less a teenager going into the 20s, listened to the radio in France four times a day, because you never knew when Hitler was going to attack. He attacked always on weekends and not. But you never knew when he was going to attack, and an attack with a refugee like me was life and death. In other words, there were people who lived, like me in the 30s, lived a real life where you didn't know what you were having to do the next day. And all this depended, in a sense, was Hitler going to attack or not. A completely uprooted, insecure life, because you had to have facts and be ready to move on. And soon Hitler would take it into his mind to attack wherever you might be, not only because of him, if he got you in the dead, but also, of course, those countries would immediately imprison you as a German. Did happen, of course. So, whatever you have, this was a world in Germany, but not in France and England, of this kind of insecurity. You just did not. You just did not. I always say, God knows what the Americans will react. But they're hysterical people, and I would like to be here when once this kind of thing happens in America. I would have to leave. Because I don't know if Americans should take it. It's coming. It's coming. There's already been a putsch in Saudi Arabia next week. There'll be more of a putsch. One day it'll fall. It'll come. It'll be interesting to see, uninteresting for me, how the Americans react. Because they've never had this before. But this tremendous insecurity, where you just do not know. So either you react by the fairy tale, the happy and healthy world, which the Nazis, or you react by a new pragmatism. Culturally, the new pragmatism is important. Or rather, there are two better ways. There's a better way. Pragmatism is a bad translation. Forget it. The new sobriety. Willett calls it the new sobriety. That's the good translation. Because it kind of sobers you up. I mean, for intellectual, it's very difficult in those things to go away and be terrible. Or to believe in a happy, healthy world. It's more easy for the lower classes, in a sense, but for a conscious intellectual, it's of course not easy at all to do. Now this new sobriety you find everywhere in the Weimar Republic. You find it in the cabaret, as I tried to explain today. It is of course part of the proletarian theater. What is more sober? And the what is less?
the one is more sober than theater, in which you're not supposed to become involved, which you just look at the spectator. That's complete sobriety, yes? But it also goes into other fields, into industrial art and advertisement, something I want to come back to a little later. But in the new advertising, in industrial art, you have sobriety, which means in this case functionalism, an increased functionalism in sobriety, in advertising, and above all, in artistic design. This new sobriety is symbolized by the new architecture. But this new architecture is, of course, the lasting, unfortunately, the lasting heritage of life. This new architecture, which started again as a socialist endeavor and ended up as the Seagram building in New York City. Yeah, I'm not kidding you, all this monstrosity in which we live. In other words, the new architecture started as socialist and revolutionary, and it ended up in the highest humanity of all these abominations which dehumanize our life. The worst is, of course, Helen White. Only non-humans would ever enter. So, this dehumanizing architecture, the architecture of domination, I would call it, starts as the architecture of the world. And it starts as the center of the new sobriety. And it starts in a movement that is socialist and even communist. By the title of the Bauhaus. Bauhaus means simply, in shrewdness you will see with the idea of simplicity and craftsmanship, a master craftsman's house. That's really the best translation. The house of a master craft. They call themselves Bauhaus, really a medieval term. In medieval German you have this, of a house of a master craft. And to this new architecture, I will come there next time. Yeah?